Committee will come to order. We do have a quorum present, and Representative Albright moves the minutes from January 31st, 2017. Are there any additions, subtractions, or changes? Seeing none, all those in favor of adoption of the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
All right. Those opposed, no. Minutes are adopted. We will begin, continue going through the governor's budget today. Within the packets, we have the handout materials from DHS, and we also have the budget books, which we will be referring to. And we will have Commissioner Johnson here to kick us off. Commissioner Johnson, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Chuck Johnson, I serve as Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Human Services. I'm going to start off today talking about the part of the governor's budget related to direct care and treatment, and then Assistant Commissioner Koppel will talk about Children and Family Services. Assistant Commissioner Wilson will follow that to talk about behavioral health, and then I'll be back at the end. We still have time to talk about our better government proposals. So starting with direct care and treatment, as we look at direct care and treatment, as the commissioner talked about when she was here yesterday, our primary concern continues to be resources and ensuring that we have the adequate staffing in our facilities to care for the people in our care, to ensure safety for our patients and our staff, and to ensure that we're in compliance with the regulations we're doing. When we're in a 24/7 healthcare business, where 80% of the dollars are going to staff, this is generally about staffing and ensuring we have adequate staffing levels to provide care to people. And start by thanking you for the funding that was provided last year. We are in the process, as we talked about a couple weeks ago in this committee, of rolling out the pieces that we did last year. But we do have some additional needs that we're bringing to you this year for our direct care and treatment area. We'll talk about five proposals, and then we have three others that I'll cover probably more quickly, starting with the Security Hospital and then also talking about Minnesota State Operated Community Services. Commissioner touched on each of these yesterday. They're certainly big parts of what we want to do this year in direct care and treatment and the issues we're bringing before you. In addition to the reform of sex offender treatment, the CABS program, and some security items. Starting with the request by the governor for the Minnesota Security Hospital. This is a request for $22.9 million. We'll fund about 124.5 FTEs in fiscal year 19 to support the work in the Security Hospital. This is a request we're bringing back to the legislature. We did bring it in 2016, and it was not funded, and so we're bringing it back for consideration this year. As the commissioner said yesterday, the staffing ratio we have at the Security Hospital right now is 2.1, meaning 2.1 staff per patient. When we look at similar kinds of hospitals around the country, we can identify a couple that were very similar, and their staff-to-patient ratios were 3.3 to 1. So we're significantly off the pace of how other facilities in the country serving a similar population have staffed themselves. This proposal will bring us up to 2.7 to 1. So it isn't getting us all the way to that 3.3, but it is closing that gap. We believe it would make a significant difference in terms of the investment in the Security Hospital. But from our perspective, it isn't just the total number of staff, it's having the right staff in place as well. We are also behind in ratios and comparisons with similar facilities for the number of psychiatrists we have, just as an example. We have a psychiatrist at MSH for every 42 of our patients. The Oregon State Hospital that we compare ourselves to, a very comparable type of facility, has one psychiatrist for each 18 patients. So a significant difference. And actually, the Fulton State Hospital in Missouri is 1 to 15, so even lower than that. So psychiatrists are one of the positions that we want to hire for. Representative Cossendine asked yesterday about this. We are really focusing on direct care staff and on clinical staff, and those are the staff that are most of the positions we'll be going to support safety and clinical care and quality treatment at the Security Hospital. As we discussed here a couple weeks ago, we've made some pretty significant improvements at the Security Hospital. We do have better injury numbers this past year than we did the year before, but we continue to believe that in order to provide the right level of treatment for seriously mental ill people that are committed to us, that we need to have additional staff to meet that need. Uh, Mr. Chair, the next item is on pages 192
and 120. It's all right. We might have questions that come up. We'll see how the flow goes. Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and Deputy Commissioner Johnson. If we were able to achieve some of those, like, Oregon staffing levels with treatment professionals, could we do? You expect that we'd also see a shorter length of stay? Because our average of, I think, is over 7 years. That's a pretty big chunk of someone's life. And is there a relationship, as far as you know, with that kind of professional treatment capability and shortening length of stay?
Commissioner Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Loeffler, definitely one of our focuses in having more clinical and more direct care staff is to speed up the pace at which treatment moves. I don't know directly the relationship with psychiatrists in particular. I could ask if Carol Olson knows. She could come down and potentially talk to that. But generally speaking, that's a metric that we're looking at relative to our treatment within the hospital. And the concern that we don't have adequate staffing to provide the treatment that helps people move through treatment more quickly, and that's one of the metrics that we're looking at in terms of improving what we do at the Security Hospital.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, because it does seem to me that as we evaluate all these requests, I mean, if we could shorten the length of stay, we'd have more bed capacity. You know, we've heard about all the backlogs along the way. It would do more than just what it happens on the campus. I think it would have a system effect.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, Commissioner, I don't know if you're the one to ask this or not, but I have some of these staff members who live in my district, and one of them said that some of the management rules make the staffing very difficult. And the example they gave was if there's a security breach and the unit has to be evacuated, patients have the right of refusal. They can actually stay, you know, where the breach is or stay in the area, and they have to assign a staff member to them. So if you had half the patients not willing to evacuate, you'd have to have one staff member, according to the current rules, for every patient that decided not to leave the area. I mean, so again, it raises my concern that some of the techniques used for both the protection of staff and staffing in general, a lot of it has to do with rules and regulations that they're using that make the situation much worse than what it has to be. Do you have any response to that?
Commissioner Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Grunhagen, I don't know specifically about that example. It doesn't seem to me that if you have a urgent situation that you would want to leave people in potential place where it could be dangerous. This is a residential treatment facility, and patients who live in a residential treatment facility do have rights to make decisions within the confines of their commitment. So it is possible there are some rules that govern how they would behave in such a situation. I can follow up and get you more information on that particular kind of example.
Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, and again, this, you know, is probably a year-old comment. But the other thing they complained about, I think this particular staff member is retired now, if I remember right, is that the ratio of management to staff members is way out of whack. And again, I was on the school board for a period of time, and we always had complaint about too many administrators versus, you know, the staff in the school. That always seemed to be a bone of contention, so I understand that. But it's a consistent concern I've heard raised by some of the people who lived, that worked there, that lived in my district over the last several years. And so it just raises the whole concern for me that we're operating in a way to maximize the number of staff that we need versus doing it more efficiently and effectively in a way that protects the safety of the staff and works within the limits that we have currently. I don't expect you to give me a succinct answer on that. I just appreciate your feedback on that issue because I've got additional information I'm collecting on it.
Thank you, Commissioner Johnson. Please continue. I'm sorry, Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Johnson, Representative Grunhagen got a little bit into what I wanted to ask, but he also brought up another subject about an incident that happened real recently at one of the facilities where this exact situation where he was talking about, where one of the clients refused to leave. I come from a law enforcement background. In an emergency situation, people can be required to leave. And not just for their safety, but the safety of everybody. I understand there was quite a bit of damage done to the facility down there where this person was at. And a staff member had to stay with him, endangering that client and the staff member. That's a concern to me. But he also brought up the staff and management or supervisor ratio. You talk about a 2.1 to client. I'd like to know, if we can get the information, what is the staff-to-supervisor ratio and administrative, and what are these other facilities that you brought up, what's their staff-to-supervisor and administrative ratio as well? So we have a better idea where we stand.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, we are actually gathering metrics on that. This question had come up in an earlier hearing about the staffing, staff to management ratio. My own observation is that I'm not sure that that's the case. I think there are people who work in the facility who may not be the people that are on the floor all the time but are also not managers. I'm talking about clinical staff or doctors or others who are providing the medical care and therapy for people. Those people are equally important to moving treatment along, even though they're not necessarily the ones like the nurses or the security people who are actually, you know, in a unit with the patients at all times. But I don't consider that to be management or overhead. So I think we need to sort that out a little bit and give you some good metrics on what we see in terms of management. I know that in terms of 124 positions that we're asking for that would result in 2019, there's a couple of executive leadership positions in there. There's, I think, six clinical administrators and there's a bonding manager. So nine of those positions are arguably more management. The rest are all in the treatment or people who will be right on the floor.
Thank you, Commissioner. Please continue.
The next page that I'll be covering is on 119 and 120 in your budget book. This relates to the Minnesota State Operated Community Services. Again, the Commissioner touched on this yesterday. These are the 120 or so homes that we operate around the state that provide care for people with disabilities in the community. As you're aware, the challenge with this particular part of our programming has really been a funding challenge, and appreciate the legislature providing us with the deficiency money last year to carry us through 2017. What we're in the process of doing now is essentially defining that transition that we need to make in our business and how we need to change our business to bring ourselves back down so we don't need to have the subsidy coming from the legislature to support the program. This is an enterprise service, meaning that it generally lives off of its own revenues. We generally earn the kind of rates that other providers do in the community for serving people with disabilities. What we're doing now is listed on this slide. These are the steps that we're taking to bring the cost down, cost structure down within MSOC to put us in a position to be closer to being self-sustaining going out into the future. And so the request that's in front of you has money for essentially helping us make that scale down in the deficiency of $6.7 million in 2018, $1.6 million in 19 and 20, and then that would actually zero out in 2021 when the banding comes off of the rates and we're able to believe that then we'd be able to live off of the rates. In addition to this, we're asking for $1 million a year ongoing, and this is related to a need that has really become more acute to us as we've moved into something of a safety net role, where we're caring for those individuals that other providers won't or can't care for. And this is for starting up homes. We often have individuals or people more than one at a time that we're trying to place into a home, And to place them into a home, we need to spend money up front in order to secure the home, modify the home, often bring in staff for a couple months prior to staffing the home to train them and bring them on board. Those upfront costs aren't covered anywhere else, and we think an appropriation would help be a good way to offset that. So we can fulfill the safety net role of caring for some of those individuals that have more intense needs and require different kind of physical environment or more staffing than we see with the standard four-bedroom group home that are around the state. In addition, and not on this page, but I'll talk about it later, is a portion of the operating adjustment request is also to support the salary increases or salary adjustment for people in the MSOX part of our budget. So in that respect, historically, MSOX has kind of lived off of the revenues. We don't believe we can, going forward, without having the operating adjustment added in, make the MSOX balance, even with the steps that we're taking that are here on this slide. The steps we're in the process of, I actually talked about in this committee, I believe it was last week or the week before, the increasing crisis rates and the work we're doing now in the second bullet there around converting a number of ICF intermediate care facilities over to four-bedroom group homes, which will provide a more stable form of revenue to cost ratio for us going forward. And then a number of other steps that we have lined up. Going through all of these steps is what will bring us to the point where we believe that by 2021 we won't need an additional subsidy beyond the operating adjustment we're asking for elsewhere in the budget. The next page relates to the sex offender program. This is in your budget book on pages 131 to 132. We have about 722 individuals we're caring for now in the sex offender program who committed to us for treatment for sex offenses. The biggest change that's happened to this program over the course of the last couple of years has been the dramatic pace of movement through the program and the number of men that we now have that are on the St. Peter campus outside of the razor wire in what we call the community preparation services. We have a total of 89 people in that program right now and have a couple who are waiting to get in as well. This is the part of the program that is the last stage of treatment before individuals are potentially discharged or provisionally discharged. The challenge with this has been with the increasing population in that part of the program, we need to have the increased staff in order to support treatment for those individuals. And so this page requests 26 FTEs to support the programming within the community preparation services. We also have a bonding request for phase two work in St. Peter on the sex offender program, which would add more beds to the two buildings that are outside of the razor wire. Again, expecting this is going to be a continuing growth in this part of the program. In addition...
Excuse me.
Yes.
You had an additional 26 FTEs for the 89 in the... community preparation services. How many people are there now?
I'm looking, Mr. Chair. I think I have that. Mr. Chair, I don't have that number here, but I can get it for you.
That'd be great. Thank you.
In addition, we'll bring back another proposal that we had brought forward last year. This is for the individuals who are provisionally discharged from the program. We have seven people who have been provisionally discharged, six more who have been provisionally discharged but are still waiting for housing in the community. When individuals are provisionally discharged, we're still responsible for the care and security of those individuals in their community placement, meaning the MSOP program budget pays for them. A few years ago, we added a 25% county share to new commitments that were coming into the sex offender program. We would like to propose to also have that 25% county share apply when individuals are placed to the community because we have continuing costs on those cases that are provisionally discharged. The next proposal on pages 123-124 of your budget book is the Child and Adolescent Behavioral Health Services. This is the home or the hospital for children with severe mental illness or behavioral challenges in Willmar. This is a program we've gone kind of back and forth on where it falls within our continuum of care over the last couple of years. You recall that last year we shared information with you that the landlord who holds the building that we're in Willmar had told us that he was going to end our lease on June 30th of this year. We have since done some more negotiation with that individual and are working on extending that lease for 2 years so we can stay in the same building in Willmar. What this budget page asks for are the dollars for the lease cost of staying in the building for another 2 years and the increase in the lease cost with the new negotiations on the lease with the landlord. This also ties to a governor's budget request, or bonding request, I'm sorry, for building a new facility in the Willmar area to support the CABS program going forward. And so our strategy now is to work for 2 more years in the current building and hopefully transition over to a new building. The new building would be a significant advantage for us because it would be structured in a way that would allow us to actually care for as many as 16 children at one time. The building we have now, the program we have now, is licensed for 16 beds, but because of the structure of the building, it's really hard to have 16 behavioral challenged kids in that building all at the same time. So we're running, you know, below 8 now, usually in census, and 8 is probably the most we could ever take there based on our staffing and the facility. The next request is around security and electronic monitoring. This is on pages 125, 126 of your budget book. This is a request to really put in place some dedicated, sustainable funding for security and electronic monitoring across all of our programs within direct care and treatment. We really don't have such a funding source now, and to the extent we do need to fund these kinds of services or these kind of equipment and security systems, it really comes ad hoc as we can find money within the operating budget. As a result, what happens is a lot of our equipment is not up to date, needs maintenance, needs replacement, and we're always scrambling to find money to do that. This proposal would support a purchase of 800 megahertz radios, which is a standard for how to share information and for security purposes across facilities, 1,700 new cameras across our facilities, and the replacement and maintenance of 2,000 existing cameras we have within our facilities. And it would carry forward so that instead of having to scramble for money, we'd actually have a dedicated source, a staff person is dedicated to maintaining our security equipment as we go forward. A few other items that are also in the budget on the direct care and treatment side. The first one, oversight response teams, is an item we're bringing back from last year. It was a portion of a request that was not funded. It's actually a reduced request this year. It's from some additional FTEs to put at the system-wide level to really help us manage across all the programs and facilities that we operate on quality, on health management information, on compliance and related items. And so it's really trying to build more of that system perspective across all the facilities and programs that we run and provide the FTEs to ensure that we can manage the system properly. We also have a system modernization request of $2 million, $1 million a year. Those funds are for really building out electronic health records. We have a system we use in most of DCT that now is called Avatar, which we use for tracking individuals and patient records. But we only have about 20% of our information is electronic, and the other 80% is still on paper. This results in a lot of challenging transactions and a lot of extra staff work that has to go into gathering paper when we're transitioning a patient to another place for care, or when we're trying to gather information for a court or other kind of legal interaction. And we're just behind the times and where we need to be with electronic health records. And so this investment is really to help us build out so we can get more of our work done electronically. And then finally, we're proposal to transfer the responsibility for the judicial appeal panels from DHS to the courts. As you're aware, Supreme Court appeal panels oversee and have hearings on custody decisions within the sex offender program. And so that means that anytime someone wants to move to community preparation service for provisional discharge, that goes through a SCAP panel for review. Historically, we, DHS, have paid the Supreme Court for the cost of those panels. And that just evolved over time. But as we've been talking about this recently, that's kind of a conflict of interest because we're actually a party in those transactions as they're happening. We shouldn't really be the ones who are paying the jurists for making the decisions and determinations on the outcome of those custody decisions. So this would transfer those dollars to the courts. We add some additional dollars for the courts because we need more of the Supreme Court appeals panels because of the volume of individuals we have coming through for custody determinations has increased greatly over what it was in the past. Mr. Chair, that's...
Excuse me, Commissioner Johnson. Representative Liebling has a question.
Thank you. And I guess you were just wrapping up, I guess. But so that's an interesting issue about the conflict of interest that's kind of inherent in having DHS paying that judicial panel. But what I wonder about that, though, is if the authority or the responsibility for funding this is transferred to the courts, which, as you know, is an independent branch of government, is there a continuing obligation on the courts, then, to continue funding it? I mean, if the courts are short of resources at some point in the future, could the judicial branch just simply say we're going to cut the SCAP panel or you know, something similar? And that, you know, maybe you're not the right person to answer that, but I mean, this obviously had to have been thought through. Could you address that?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, I think that that's a good point. I think that's kind of how we got to where we are, which is this was created as a process that needed to happen, and the courts came to us and said, well, we don't have any money to pay for this. How are we going to do this? And so we ended up being the ones paying for it. So we're trying to separate that line and trying to put the responsibility on the court side, say this is your obligation and this is something that you need to carry out going forward, which means if you need additional funding, you need to go get additional funding to do it. I can't tell you that it won't happen, that in the future this conversation will circle back in the other direction and they'll be coming back to us and saying, we need another panel, we don't have any money, can you give us some money? And we're just trying to get the line drawn in the right place going forward as much as we can.
So, Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, it makes me wonder whether there will be any statutory obligation on the judicial branch or whether we even can put an obligation on the judicial branch to continue with this service. Do you know? I mean, would this proposal need to go to the Judiciary Committee, perhaps, or is it just simply moving the funding without any statutory change on who's responsible?
Commissioner Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Representative Liebling, that's a really good question. I can check into that and see what language we were planning on putting around that to see if that is going to help address the issue that you're raising. I believe this will have to go to the Judiciary Committee as well because it does involve money for the courts.
Additional questions? I just have one, Commissioner. Just in terms of the budget book and DHS specifically, I think you've broken apart the FTEs kind of per the sheets in the PowerPoint that you have. Do you have for DHS in total a total number of FTE increases?
Mr. Chair, within the governor's budget?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, possible that Alex Kutza has that information. I don't have it right here with me.
Okay.
Alex is looking.
Okay.
We can certainly get it to you, Mr. Chair. It's.
And was the, just looking specifically at the largest numbers of FTEs appear to be staffing at the security hospital and sex offender treatment facilities in St. Peter and Moose Lake. Do the staffing requests, do they overlay exactly with the requests that you had for last year? Are they a little bit more, a little bit different, do you know?
Mr. Chair, the request at the security hospital is actually a little bit less than what we requested last year. It's the same staffing request, but it's spread out over a five-year phase-in rather than a three-year phase-in, which is what we proposed last year, so it kind of ramped up more quickly. It was more costly and brought more FTEs in more quickly. That's the biggest difference between this year and last year in terms of the security hospital.
All right. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself, Alex, and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Alex Kutz. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the Department of Human Services. So overall, the governor's budget proposes 670 FTEs in fiscal year 18 and 704 FTEs in fiscal year 19. I can send more breakdown to all of the members. One piece I would mention in that is that the operating adjustment FTEs are maintained FTEs but are counted here. So they're not new FTEs. That's the funding we need to maintain our existing FTEs. So I can send those net FTEs to you later.
Could you just repeat that whole thing again for me, please?
It's always confusing, Mr. Chairman. So as part of this budget, the requirements in our, when we present the budget to you, the operating adjustment is funding for our agency to maintain our existing FTEs, and as part of the change page, we're required to reflect how many FTEs that would be if we were not funded. So it says on there maintained FTEs instead of new FTEs. So we're not hiring new people. That's simply the money we need to pay for our existing complement of FTEs. That's a large number of the FTEs on here. That's why I wanted to mention it. But overall, the total, including maintained FTEs, is 670 FTEs in fiscal year 18 and 704 FTEs in fiscal year 19.
And do we have an idea of a breakdown of where, at what level those employees are going to be added? For example, at the security hospital, if there's classifications by job title or by level, and then also by union, if those are available for us in the request.
Mr. Chair, yes, we have that information for the security hospital. We would for our other positions, too. We'd have a plan for what type of position it is that we're hiring for.
Okay. And that, I know that that has been somewhat controversial in the past, is, you know, we've got a great need in this area, and we, you know, that the funding is directed towards that, and then staffing is added in another area to elite, which doesn't alleviate the stress. So we want to make sure that we can get as good information as we can about the policies towards hiring and for the different facilities particularly, and also if it wasn't successful, if we were, for whatever we did before, to add people at a certain staffing level to alleviate overtime, if that wasn't effective, then what's the plan for moving forward so that we can actually get people hired at that level? So I think that before committing additional dollars, that those are going to be some of the questions that members have for the staffing. But And also, I think the breakdown of what the additional staffing requests are and at what level will be helpful. And I'm still confused about what's a new person and what's new dollars and how we add that. Representative Considine.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, my question is for you. When we're developing the bill, can we put it right in the bill that this is only for security counselors, for example?
Representative Considine, I don't know that we have done that in the past. I'd have to look, and I'd be happy to find that out for you, how prescriptive that we have been in the past. I know that we do what we call policy statements, where we put in the language what our legislative intent is, but I don't know that we've ever been prescriptive about, you know, hiring at different staffing levels, and I don't know, but we'll find out.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I share some of your concerns about that.
Mr. Chair, I could add a...
Commissioner Johnson.
It looks like half of those 700 FTEs that Ms. Kutzle cited are the maintained FTEs in the operating adjustment. So those are essentially counted as being, if we don't get the operating adjustment, that's the fund, we lose funding, we won't have funding for that 350 positions. What actually happens to them is still a management decision we make as we move forward, but that's counts for about half of those total of 700.
Thank you, Commissioner. Additional questions? All right.
I think, Mr. Chairman, I'll turn it over to Assistant Commissioner Jim Koppel for Children and Family Services.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner. Welcome back to the committee, Commissioner Koppel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Jim Koppel. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services, and I'll proceed with an overview of our budget. Just an introductory, what we were and continue to struggle with is to get our, we work in Children and Family Services programs include IMPEP and SNAP, child protection, child support, child care, and grants, many anti-poverty grants to dozens of nonprofits, community agencies. And our goal is self-sufficiency for families. We want to see families move out of poverty and into self-sufficiency, off of public benefits, into employment, and be self-sufficient. And our concern is that oftentimes we and the programs we operate don't necessarily provide the pathways for those families to get there. And I think that's a mutual concern for all of us. It's just the struggle is how do we realign our programs and move forward to get there. So that's kind of our problem statement is can we get our programs to meet our goals? And in our budget asks this year, we are trying to realign some of our programs to accomplish that. This is not a one-size-fits-all nor a simple task. So when I say we realign our services, it is not a complete job. It's just a movement in that direction with that goal in mind. Our total ask, net ask, is $78.7 million in fiscal year 18-19. The biennial ask. It's also a net ask. We have some costs. We have some savings. And as a result, I'm giving you the net of those two. The major areas that are included in that budget are to improve child protection, specifically in permanency and foster care area, services for sexually exploited youth and homeless youth, supporting tribal expansion of our child welfare programming, and in child care, which our major initiative is around ensuring quality, stability, and integrity in our child care program. I'll start with child care. This, as you see, $73.5 million is the majority of our ask. But this is a number of things. It is in response to, in 2014, Congress passed the reauthorization of the Child Care Development Block Grant. In 2016, we had a finalization of all the regulations related to that reauthorization. And what this budget request reflects two things. There are dramatic program improvements and improvements in reimbursement to providers, but they're also conforming to that federal legislation so that we are not found in out of conformity and at risk of any future lost funds to our block grant that we receive from the federal government. Among the things that it does, you know, we want to make sure that the quality of child care gets kids ready for school and keeps them safe and has practices of safety. We want to make it easier for families to receive the assistance. And when I say that, it's not changing what the eligibility criteria is as much as stability. And once you're in the program, it has more predictability to it. So you know that you have child care and you're going to have it it's going to remain at a particular cost to your family for, in this case, a full year. And specifically, there is an outreach to families who are homeless, and there is a specific section which will allow about 250 homeless families to get access to child care and have a period of time up to 3 months to provide all the information they need to remain on the program. And then lastly, and very importantly, it improves the rates paid to child care providers. About $40 million of that $73.5 million is in reimbursement to providers based on a more recent market survey. It doesn't bring us above the 25th percentile, where it's just where we're at now, but it is based on a more recent market survey. The current market survey we use is 2011, so it's been quite a while since we've updated. This is a federal requirement, but it also, as you know from a number of articles about the pressures on providers, child care, this increase in reimbursement is a modest effort to meet those needs. We also have some cost-saving pieces in this $16.9 million. And what we highlighting here is the limits to care when children are multiple providers. We have some families that use multiple providers, and in some cases those providers can both bill for a full week just based on the number of days, hours that they've served, and it costs more money, obviously, when we do that. So now we have limited that. And as a result, we'll have some savings there. We limit payments to child care centers that care for large numbers of their own employees' children. That's also a considerable cost savings. And lastly, we increase fraud disqualification periods so that providers who have committed fraud have a longer on any repeat violators, et cetera, will have longer disqualification periods. So when I, at the beginning, when I said we had a request of around $78 million as a net number, this is subtracting out this savings is included in that number as a net. Next big item is in child protection, foster care, and permanency. As many of you know, we're here in 2015 when we passed the North Star program, which was implemented. Actually, it was implemented in 2015, so it was passed in 2014, very quickly implemented. We did not include, due to lack of funding, we did not include parity for children under the age of six. So what the whole North Star was about was when you were in foster care or temporary placement, you receive services. When you are adopted, those get cut in half, so, and many of them get cut in half. For instance, you get $400 a month for child care and foster care, you get $200 after adoption. What we wanted to do, this was a disincentive to permanency, so people weren't adopting kids. They remained in foster care because the benefits, many of the benefits were maintained, therefore. And so we wanted to encourage permanency and adoption. We changed that, but we didn't have enough money at that time. You didn't have enough money at that time to say, let's do it for all children. And so what we want to do is not have people wait until a child turns six to adopt them. We want to have all children under age six on the same parity and encourage permanency. And that's the biggest cost and the biggest item as part of our child protection improvements. We also want to improve and increase oversight of county and tribal child protection activities. This is really in response to, we've had a 24-hour hotline where counties can call us and say we have a question, you know, we don't know where this, we got a complicated case, what's the next steps we should take. We also go out on a quality control basis and we review cases with counties. We go through all counties over a three-year period. But we're not able to really, and this has come up, is where we would actually, at a county's request, assign a worker to go to that county and work with them to improve their practices. We really can need to have a quality improvement, continuous quality improvement process with counties, but we need to have people who have the time to go out and work with counties one-on-one to bring them to that place. We're on a mission, really, to get to a high-quality child welfare system, and we're only going to get there by working with counties and bringing counties to that place, not by punishing or calling it out or do a gotcha. It's got to be this cooperative arrangement. And we also want to develop policies and practice that do get to better outcomes for children and then help counties with the implementation of those practices. And lastly, there's a pilot with older youth. The biggest feeder of homeless youth are kids aging out of foster care. That's the biggest feeder system into homeless youth. And we want to, as part of the Interagency Council on Homelessness, this is a pilot in connection with that. We want to do a better job, and the feds have passed some legislation that helps us with this. So, for instance, right now at 18, you age out of foster care. You have a choice to stay in or not till 21. If you leave it, you don't get to come back. So you may have a great plan. You're going to go to college, and you think you're going to do well. All of a sudden, you're struggling. You drop out. You free fall. This allows you to come back into the foster care system, for instance. It's one of the many things. So this is the continuous process that we're in a very complex area of child welfare, that we're just trying to continue to meet needs of kids who have struggled, had struggles, and have so much instability in their life that we need to always be there to catch them when they're struggling. So,
excuse me, Commissioner Koppel. Representative Fisher has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First of all, I want to say I'm really encouraged and glad to see the governor's budget focusing on the issues of the foster care youth who have aged out. Working homeless youth shelter, we see this issue on a regular basis, and I'm encouraged to see the other practices that you're putting in to try to help make sure that we can get keep kids in stable situations. One thing I didn't see that I have experienced from time to time is that there's just situations where foster kids have nowhere to go, and as a result, some of the counties are placing them in homeless youth shelters and housing their kids and making them homeless in the process. Are other things being looked at the system to try to, and this is hitting the kids that are more in that 15, 16, 17-year-old range.
Commissioner mm-hmm. Koppel.
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Fisher, I think we are. There are counties where this is more prevalent, and there is a dramatic shortage of foster care homes for children, and oftentimes by the time a child reaches a youthful age, 15, 16, it's both a combination of trying to find a foster care home for them, but also find a place for them where they are appropriately placed, because at that age, a home may not be the right place, whether it's a facility or some other placement where in the community but in a different environment. That makes it more complicated, and I think that those resources vary greatly across the state. That's part of the challenge we face in child protection, is resources vary. 60% of our child welfare system is paid for by counties, about 15-18% by the state, and the rest by the feds. So this is a county system, by and large, county financed. And those counties that have revenues can respond. Those counties that don't have property tax rich revenues or affordable revenues, they're not going to be able to raise monies when the number, especially in recent couple of years where we've seen huge spikes in the number of kids that have been, a number of calls received, number of cases screened in, and those counties are going to struggle with those resources more so. So to answer your question, Representative Fisher, is it's going to vary across the state. I think that's part of what I mentioned earlier about working with counties who have specific needs, who want to do specific things in response to those needs, including the homeless youth under 18. There's also federal legislation on sex trafficked youth, and that those sex trafficked youth should be treated as in the foster care system, which brings another group of youth appropriately into the system, but also into a system that's fairly burdened now and struggles to meet those needs. So I can't give you a good answer on that, except that we are well aware of it. We know that's an area we need to spend more time on. We need to spend more time with those youth, getting them prepared as they are maybe going to age out. If they decide to age out at 18, they need to have clear plans, clear futures, and as stable a future as we can provide for them. Including some, you know, there is funding available for tuition costs. So there are opportunities, but
with.
It's a challenge, as you know.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just a little bit more, just a little deeper, and I know that one of the issues that sometimes comes up with the foster care kids are those who try to get driver's licenses. You know, this is a huge problem. You have kids who are trying to get driver's license so they can get to school, get to jobs, etc. But because of the way things are set up right now, insurance companies would charge outrageous premiums, and as a result, these kids end up getting a driver's license and lose their license because they have no way to get back and forth. And I was wondering, have you folks looked at that part of the system? Because that seems to be a huge barrier that would allow people to move out of poverty.
Commissioner Koppel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Fisher. You know, the new federal law, the prudent parenting, which basically encourages parents. In the past, when you've been a foster parent, you have a youth, let's just say 16, who maybe wants to play sports, maybe wants to go to a camp in the summer, maybe wants to get a driver's license. Those are all liabilities. Those were all chances you're taking with a youth who's maybe been in the system for a while, maybe does have some behavioral issues. You don't have but you want to work with them. And so now under federal legislation, it's actually encouraged that foster parents do this. And a little later, one of the smaller requests we have is around insurance for foster care. And those premiums are going to go up. And the reason why they're going to go up is because we're going to have foster care kids, more, we hope, getting their driver's license, more foster families participating in sports and doing the things that a typical kid of that age is going to do. And we all, I shouldn't say this, but, you know, my daughter turned 16, got her driver's license, and I think my insurance was canceled 6 months later following her third accident. But that happens. That's what the beautiful thing that we can laugh about now.
You're not laughing.
I can now.
Okay.
But anyway, those are the things that every child gets the opportunity or should get the opportunity to take that next step. Hopefully more successfully than one of my daughters did.
Thank you. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, thanks for your testimony, Commissioner Koppel. I'm encouraged by it, especially the recognition of how we should reinforce traditional families. You know, there's an article here that does an analysis of federal statutes, and it does acknowledge how most welfare programs penalize marriage. And that's been a bone of contention of mine for a long time, if you've been around here at all. And, in fact, it says that children born to married mother and father are 80% less likely to be poor. 80%. And I saw another study a few years older that said if children living in poverty lived in a two-parent mother and father family, 90% of them would be out of poverty. So I really applaud you for wanting to come up with welfare benefits that actually reinforce the family rather than tear it apart. By the way, just for the record, the Affordable Care Act also penalizes marriage, okay? Just like our welfare programs do. And that's for another day, but it's basically the same worthless mentality, in my opinion. But I could use other words, but I'll choose to leave it with that. Anyway, interesting in this February 2016 article, it says that in regards to the TANF, federal TANF program, three of the four legislative goals passed at the federal level involve promoting healthy marriage, okay? But it says, regrettably, after two decades, nearly all states have simply ignored this legislation. So I think there's an area for you to look at, the TANF funds, that there's federal support, evidently, according to this analysis, that would allow you to modify some programs to actually support traditional marriage. The article goes on, and this comes from the Heritage Foundation, that the earned income tax credit should be modified to support traditional marriage. And it says that the current earned income tax credit is a $60 billion national program. Now, I don't know how much Minnesota gets, but to me, I think the new administration would be open to applying for waivers to redo these programs in a way that support traditional marriage. And the last comment, and then I'll ask my question, is, you know, there's another study out there, and I used to have a copy of it, that showed if minority children were raised in a two-parent family, not only would you reduce the achievement gap, which we have one of the largest in the nation in our state, and I know we've been working on it, but if they were raised in a two-parent family, this study said not only would you reduce the achievement gap, you'd eliminate it. And look at the tens of millions of dollars we spend trying to solve that, and yet the study showed that if you reinforce traditional marriage, you'd solve the problem much cheaper and more effectively. So are you considering applying for waivers where you can redo some of these welfare programs that penalize marriage and traditional families and instead modify them in a way to support traditional marriage?
Mr. Koppel. Representative Grunhagen and Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, there is nothing in this budget request specific to that. I will recall something that Representative McDonald we worked on in 2015 and have implemented now, and it isn't exactly, I want to back up and just say in what I've presented thus far, it's making sure that children have the supports they need to have a healthy development and a financial economic stability to succeed, to graduate, lead productive lives. And I can't and don't know how to shape a successful family, but I do know that it helps when you have both parents involved in a child's life, whether they're married or they're not married. And so in 2015, we brought a it wasn't even part of governor's budget. It was Representative McDonald introduced it and ended up getting adopted. Representative Dean was on the conference committee, and it was a legislation that allowed us to disregard child support, a certain part of child support, so that a family on MFIP receiving child support could actually have their grant plus a portion of the child support, whereas in the past we used to just reduce the grant by the amount of the child support. As a result of that, and I'll bring these statistics to us, but we are collecting more child support on MFIP families. We have a higher participation rate by MFIP by absent parents contributing to MFIP families, and studies show that when a family goes off of MFIP with child support, they're less likely to come back because they do have two adults supporting those children in that family, even if it's a low-income family. And in most cases, they are in the amount of child support. So I'm really interested in promoting policies where we support children that we bring into this world. Mm-hmm. And we can do that through two-parent families, but that's not always the reality we face. Yeah. And when it's not, then what's the next best thing? Mm-hmm. And to reinforce that over and over again is what I hope to do. Thank you.
Ms. Chair?
Representative Grunhagen.
Let it be on the record, I would vote for a raise for Commissioner Koppel.
Okay.
All right.
I hear church bells.
Thank you, Commissioner Koppel. And one of the things that we have looked at is family fragmentation and its impact on child development, child welfare. But one of the things that that we also look at is racial disparities, which Representative Grunhagen brought up. Have we looked at and have you looked at, studied, and measured racial disparities and family fragmentation and the overlapping or collinear spending and on our programs and how we're looking at that?
Mr. Chair, I think I would have some data for you on that if I'm understanding your question to be a breakout by those families who
are single head of household families. Is that your point in terms of maybe divorced or maybe not, but they're single head of household, and those families utilizing benefits for instance, MFIP or prevalence, they do have it by, one of the drivers is by income, you know, by poverty statistics, and we do know in the percentage of families and breakout, you know, by communities of color and Native American, poverty rates, et cetera.
Adverse childhood experiences.
I believe some of that too, Mr. Chair.
Yeah.
Is that what you're...
I was, you know, have not seen it here, but have seen it in other studies, even within Minnesota, and just to kind of follow up on Representative Grunhagen's question. Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to kind of push back on something I heard a little bit earlier is when we were talking about trying to keep the family unit together is when using the words traditional marriage is one of the things I get a little concerned on is that it may appear then that we're minimalizing or disregarding those who are from the GLBTQ community. And one of the things I want to point out very strongly here is that, you know, when we're dealing with, you know, particularly homeless youth, a lot that come through the foster care system, a lot of our youth disproportionately fall into this range. We have anywhere at minimum 20% up to 40% of our youth who fall in these categories are in the GLBTQ community. And I've seen a lot of instances where the program I work with has a program specifically brought together to help address some of these issues where families who are GLBTQ have opened up their homes at no charge to the government. We run this program without any government assistance. And the families take in these youth who are GLBTQ with some very good results. And it's by, you know, getting to some of the core that Representative Grunhagen raised is by having a very strong family unit, strong couple working together as they take these children in. And I want to make sure that we recognize this part is a very key part is when we're dealing with a disproportionate portion of our youth who fall into this area is that they have a welcoming environment, a strong environment. And from my seeing from the GLBT community, they've been doing some of this on their own without any support from government in the past. They are very committed in these areas, but they aren't able to do it alone. So I hope that we keep that portion in the element as we're going forward.
Thank you, Representative Fisher, and I can't speak to the studies that Representative Grunhagen has seen, but I would just point you to Mitch Perlstein's work in family fragmentation in Minnesota on two-parent families, and he makes no differentiation about that. It is specifically designed towards statistics around two-parent families and what would be called intact versus traditional, I think, and perhaps that's just a different word difference, but I think that that's at least the data that I would be happy to look at with you and I think would be important to talk about within this context. Representative Halverson, I'm sorry, I forgot you on the list earlier. Sorry about that.
And just briefly, I wanted to underscore, moving back to the discussion about serving homeless youth, particularly those who are aging out of foster care. I know, Commissioner, you're aware of Lincoln Place in Eagan, which in my community is the only place in Dakota County that provides supportive housing for youth who age out of foster care. A couple things just I wanted to highlight about that. One, when Lincoln Place came into our community, I was expecting some pushback from the community, and there wasn't a peep. And it's kind of been nothing but supportive since. We find that the youth really get involved in community. There's a major economic development project that went on in that community, and they were actively engaged in helping the community decide about what they needed in terms of transit, jobs, etc. So the success, I think, in terms of what they get out of the supported housing is good. And so there's a lot of good news there, but the bad news is, and I think what we need to, the fact that the state is highlighting this is important because ever since they've opened more than 10 years ago, they've been at capacity and had a capacity waiting list in Dakota County. And so the need is very great, and I appreciate the state for recognizing that.
Representative Allen.
Thank you, you, Mr. Chair. In this discussion about the two-parent family, every time we have this, it's such an outdated discussion. But at the same time, we want to really look at families that are low-income. I mean, most of them are children, so 70% of them are children. So we're talking about a very small group. And half of them, those that are on assistance, were employed and lost their job through either their wages were too low, they couldn't have, didn't have child care, transportation, or they're having some other crisis. And so then they're only on it for 5 years. And then we forget about the historical, if you talk about Mackinac and black children, the federal housing public assistance, the way the structural racism that we talk about, how this caused the separation of two-parent families where men could not visit their children, had to sneak in the middle of the night to visit their children, otherwise their families would lose housing assistance. And American children, you know, until the 1950s were removed from their homes, and my grandmother was removed, chased down in a field when she was 7 years old, couldn't speak English, and went to a boarding school, came home, you know, saw her family once a year, could no longer speak her language, and was traumatized. I mean, there was nothing, that was not something she could overcome. And so that historical trauma is something that we don't even touch on. We try to fix it with sort of like Christian, wholesome, two-parent family language that's sort of couched into some sort of studies that are probably, that maybe are 20 years old. And so I think if we were to have a real discussion there, we should look at some of the work that the Wilder Foundation has done and some of the real more recent studies about families and the reasons why they're, the poverty and the housing issues.
All right, Commissioner Koppel, please continue. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair and members, I'm sorry, I haven't been giving you the page numbers as I've been going along here, so I apologize that I get all caught up in this stuff. I'm on under Children and Family Services, page 41, and it's also on page 65, and it's this is support Tribal Human Service Initiatives. So there are two pieces here. One is to fund Mille Lacs Tribe, as well as Red Lake Nation. They are entering their second year, will be entering the second year of planning to take over the child protection services for their families. This has occurred in Mille Lacs as well as, in Leech Lake as well as White Earth previously. And so we are in the second year of planning, and there is a second-year planning grant, which includes an FTE. That FTE is currently hired now in the first year, so it's a continuation of that one FTE for 1 year. This funding is for one more year, and then all of that is done. Ideally, the both tribes will be ready to move forward with administering their child protection system. Second is the White Earth Nation, I mentioned, already has in 2005 we passed legislation to authority to transfer child protection responsibilities from the neighboring counties to White Earth. In 2011, we expanded that to say for White Earth to take care of those Native families living outside the reservation in those counties, but we never gave them any additional funds. And so this is a request for $500,000 request for White Earth to help defray the cost of serving those additional families. Moving on, these are some of the smaller pieces of our budget requests. I'm not going to go in the order they're up there in the PowerPoint, but on page 44, to provide more comprehensive service models for children who are victims of sex trafficking. I mentioned this earlier as part of our child protection initiative is to also treat those children in the child welfare system. They are eligible for foster care and would be eligible for services as well.
This is in response to federal legislation, which we would be complying with in this. So it's kind of, I hate to say conforming to federal because these are good ideas, these are good things to do, and they're constructive, but they also conform with federal, recently passed federal legislation. And I mentioned foster care liability insurance, and that is in response to the prudent parenting where more kids have opportunities, play sports, go on overnights, go to camps, get their driver's license, drive safely, and but that's going to be an increase in foster care liability insurance, and that's at cost. The next two are in regards to child support. We have issues where there are certain records, birth records, so once a court establishes paternity paternity or maternity based on a case, these are non-4D cases, that the health department doesn't get paid. The court's supposed to pay but doesn't pay. Nobody is, I guess nobody thinks they're supposed to pay for that birth certificate to be updated with the names added. It costs $40 a birth certificate. We think there's about 1,000 cases a year, and that's this item is really to try to address that issue to make sure our birth certificates are accurate and carry all the right information. Second piece of that is to automatically change child support obligation when circumstances in a family include child care is no longer needed. So at age 13, there would be an adjustment to child care or child support based on our child care, unless there's a disability with the child, certain things like that, that would just automatically, rather than having to go to court and, ask for an adjustment. And then lastly, that on page 60 concerning SNAP, employment and training, that's actually a policy bill and won't require a budget page, so that was in here. You got it. We realized it was wrong, but we couldn't change it. You already had it, so just strike that. It'll be in the policy bill. But it's very important. And the last thing I want to cover is in child care assistance. This is in the office of the Inspector General, who does all the licensing and follow-up and investigations, et cetera. As part of the Child Care Development Block Grant, we have to change some of our licensing processes. About 40 states do now already do annual licensures for child care. We do it every 2 years. And even though we do it every 2 years, we have a ratio of inspectors or licensees to the number of clients or providers of about one staff per 175. The federal recommendation, national recommendation is 50. So we're above that, plus we need to go from 2 years down to 1 year. So we have a request in for 20 FTEs around licensing because the state licenses all child care centers. The counties license all family child care. So in our specific ask, we have asked for county grants so that they can help them pay for the additional workers they need, as well as 20 FTEs so that we can do two things. Lower the ratio of the staff to number of centers that they're working with, as well as do it annually. We also have to annually certify a legally non-licensed family child care. It's not a license, it's now a certification of those providers. And we also need to do a certification for licensed exempt centers. Those would be school-based centers or community centers or where they exist now but they don't require they're licensed exempt under state law. Those would need to be certified annually. So there's additional administrative costs there, and so that's where our FTEs, there's 48 total FTE requests in this piece, all in response to those. As I mentioned, 40 states currently did it annually, so this isn't a change for them, but we did it every 2 years, and it's a big change for us. But it is also something that would put us out of compliance if we don't. And it also, I think I wish Representative Albright was still here, because I had a discussion with him about this, is we need to have an ongoing relationship with providers. It doesn't need to be a gotcha relationship. What I talked about earlier with the child protection, we're going to a quality child protection system, and we're going to go together with counties to get there. And we need to be supporting each other in that process and feel free to call each other when we have a problem, as opposed to hide it. And that's what we need to be doing more in collaboration with our centers and with our providers in general in child care. We need to have safety, we need to have high quality, but we also, and we need to have a reimbursement system that makes it a viable profession. And we need to assure that for our families and for our children that are using it, but we also need to make it realistic and practical and, you know, doable for providers to stay in. And so it's I don't think there's a magical approach to this. I wish there was, but it's something we're aware of and that we want to work on. I think having an ongoing relationship as opposed to a two-year drop-in will improve that. But there is a cost to that as well. So with that, I will, I believe, conclude my remarks and take any additional questions. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
Thank you, Commissioner Koppel. We do appreciate it. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Mr. Koppel. I think the improvements in child care oversight and coming into federal compliance all sound like good, reasonable sorts of things. But one of the things I didn't hear you address was increased access. And last I looked, there's about 5,600 families, so about 14,000 kids around the state who are waiting on the waiting list. And is there no expectations in the revised federal law or anything else that we work harder on access?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think there was no acknowledgement in the federal legislation and funding in that federal legislation that would address that. And there is not money this year in the governor's budget that would address that. There are, to be clear, there are about 15,000 families who are eligible and not participating in child care assistance program. So when we talk about a waiting list of 5,000 or 6,000, those are just the ones that signed up. But I often compare it to a waiting list at a restaurant, that if it's a four-hour wait, you might not put your name down. If that wait got down lower, you'd put your name down again. And so I look at that demand as 15,000 for families who need access to child care that we are not serving currently. I guess I'd finish with this in response. You know, we often talk about two-generation approaches to helping families succeed, not just working with the child, not just working with the parent, but working with the whole family. And child care is about the best example we have of a program that has the capacity to provide a child with a safe, nurturing, and developmental site to be ready for kindergarten, and allow parents to work at jobs, whether their hours change, whether their wages change, they can have this continuity of care for their children and continuity of employment. And I think it's a great opportunity that we're not taking advantage of.
Thank you,
Commissioner. Representative Murphy.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and Commissioner Koppel. To this point, since I've been in the legislature, we've had a waiting list. This is not the only waiting list, but we've had this waiting list. And I don't know that you can answer this question, but I wonder what we know about the families that never made it through and never got child care. If we have any idea about their story, what they did instead. I don't really, other than anecdote, understand what that means for Minnesota families who just don't get access to child care.
Commissioner Koppel.
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, I don't have statistics like that. I do know that in a study that looked at health care and child care, is the two main reasons families go on MPIP, as to either to gain health care or to gain child care. I think those, you know, may reflect families who aren't able to get or aren't able to maintain employment or able to get employment. I also believe that the system we have for child care and for scholarships, et cetera, we're trying to serve a population better than we do. This is, again, gets back to my initial point about our outcomes we want of successful families, of self-sufficiency, of kids being ready, all kids being ready for kindergarten, getting rid of the achievement gap, and do our programs align with that? This one does not, because we are leaving, you know, up to 15,000 children, families out there who could be using this program and could be better employed, more consistently employed, and their children would be in consistent settings and being developing toward a kindergarten readiness that we all want them to have.
Thank you, Commissioner. Representative Murphy. I don't know, Representative Murphy, I was just in a center a few months ago and I met a mom who was had a pathway scholarship for her toddler, and she was going back to nursing school at Century. So there's things you can measure on both sides that we're missing out on. So appreciate that. Commissioner, anything else to wrap up? We have Representative Loeffler. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
We're good? Okay. All right. Thank you, Commissioner. We appreciate your good work. And next up we have Commissioner Wilson with Community Supports. And we got Behavioral Health. And then on we'll have Better Government and Healthcare on Thursday, February the 8th. We'll have Commissioner Johnson come back, so we won't get that out today, but we got these seven slides from Commissioner Wilson, and Better Government will be limited to one day, I guess, so I don't know. I think we should have that every day, so that's good. Commissioner Wilson, welcome to the committee. Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I'm Claire Wilson, Assistant Commissioner for the Community Supports Administration, and I know we're running short on time, so I'll move through these slides fairly quickly. I don't think I really need to go in-depth with the problem that we're facing in terms of our chemical and mental health system. Anybody with a loved one or who has personally or tried to work a constituent through the chemical and mental health system knows that it's complicated to navigate, it does not necessarily treat the whole person, and that we have great disparities in terms of access to treatment in different areas of the state. So to that end, these proposals really are working together to address and strengthen that continuum of care and look at ways that we can really treat the whole person when we talk about addiction and mental health. And so I'll just move directly to the slide on reforming substance use disorder treatment system, which is on page 177. And it is really with great acknowledgement that this proposal has been in the works for a long time, and some would say is really long overdue. The chemical health system has not really had this type of reform in decades, and so a lot of work has gone into this on the part of providers and stakeholders and counties and the state to really take a close look at our substance use disorder treatment system and make these recommendations that move us closer to a longitudinal model of care that treats this disease with the urgency that it should be treated. So the first piece of this is moving towards a system that provides direct access to care. So this proposal eliminates the need for a person to go through a Rule 25 assessment, which typically counties, tribes, or managed care organizations provided. And then they recommended the level of treatment that the individual would receive and then would place them into that treatment. This would often create delays, sometimes even up to 30 days, in terms of when treatment could be accessed. And just speaking as someone personally who has recovered from addiction, I can say that when you finally get up that courage to go get that assessment, if you are not immediately able to access treatment, your disease doesn't wait. and we lose lives in that window of time. So this allows a provider to do a comprehensive assessment, recommend a treatment level based on need, and then the individual has a choice of where they receive that treatment. And so this is a fairly significant reform. The second piece of this is enhancing our withdrawal management system. So it moves us to two new levels of withdrawal management that are medically centered. The 2015 legislature passed the standards for these services. So this really is just moving us towards the rate setting and allowing us to operationalize these two new levels of withdrawal management. And this will allow people to more readily access withdrawal management and save people from presenting in ERs and sometimes in jails with withdrawal symptoms. The next two pieces are really looking at strengthening how we provide care in the addiction system. So it's moving services into the benefit set. This includes care coordination services and peer recovery services. So similar to the certified peer specialist in mental health or community health workers in primary care, this allows people with lived experience to work within the treatment system to provide support and treatment for folks who are moving towards sobriety. It also allows care coordination to be built, and this really allows people to have their care coordinated and allows them to link to different other treatment mechanisms like primary care or other areas that will support them both in accessing recovery and then in their maybe post-treatment lives. So care coordination is a critical piece of the continuum. And finally, this will allow appropriately credentialed people who are licensed, individual clinicians, to bill directly for SUD services. So currently, they can only bill within a treatment center. This would allow for these services to be billed in the community, and so, for instance, in schools or in primary care settings. So really, once again, addressing that integration of care that's so critical for this population. And then finally, this proposal looks at the IMD concern, which, as you all know, there are facilities within Minnesota that have been designated as IMDs and so therefore are losing their federal financial participation. This proposal says that any new, and currently the state is forecasting to cover those costs. So this proposal recommends that starting in 2018, any new facility that would be extending their capacity and therefore meeting the characteristics of an IMD would need to go through a letter of need process that would both declare why that needed capacity was necessary and how that was going to be cost effective. And then finally, it calls for an analysis of the treatment system so that we can take a closer look at how are we aligning rates and treatment services, particularly residential treatment services, to assure that we're finding a sustainable model if we're going to continue to lose federal participation in IMDs. So that is the substance use disorder reform.
Excuse me, Commissioner. Yes. Representative Halverson has a question. Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Wilson. This is really exciting to hear about. I think that a lot of us have been talking for years about the need to treat substance addiction as get it back into the healthcare model, and this is kind of what I'm seeing here. I think that your point about the seamless handoff is incredibly important. As a finance committee, we look a lot at the dollars and cents, and allowing people to put their lives at risk, their health further at risk, by not getting a seamless handoff is a very big deal. And then integrating this into primary care is also extremely important, so it's something that I definitely want to continue to watch you participate in any way. One of the questions that I have is in terms of getting providers to participate in public programs when it comes to recovery services. Is that a hurdle for the state in terms of making sure that we can find the best providers throughout the state to participate, or is there a hurdle to getting providers to participate?
Mr. Chair, Representative Halverson, we certainly do not have the provider capacity currently that we need, and this is particularly true if you look at residential treatment and outpatient services, particularly in greater Minnesota. I would hope that moving some of these critical components of care into the benefit set so that people can participate and bill for those services will help in terms of access to those services. You know, it remains a struggle in terms of workforce and the fact that, you know, reimbursement rates for these services are not typically as high as they are for other medical services. So we are going to be facing challenges in terms of access to treatment beyond the confines of this proposal, but this is hopefully a first step forward.
Thank you. Representative Liebling.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I also am really excited to hear about this. And one of the, especially the talking about the seamless handoff to services, and one of the big criticisms I've had of our PMP program, our prescription monitoring program, you know, I've been really a critic of that program because one of the things, it's intended to help providers identify someone who may, in fact, be addicted, but then there's nothing for them to do. There's no requirement. There are no, it's not obvious, I think, to a lot of providers what the next step would be. And I'm wondering if there's anything in this proposal or anything that the department is working on to make better use of that information so that, you know, we're spending some amount of money to gather it, to make it work. It's been controversial in the fact that it uses pretty private data on individuals, collects the data, keeps the data. They keep wanting to expand. You know, some of us think that they have a great deal of mission creep. But the core issue of why we're collecting that data is supposed to be to help patients. And it seems to me that the chief way to do that is to give the providers, once they look in that database and say, oh, this person appears to be doctor shopping, the question is, what do I do now? So do you have anything that you're thinking about with regard to that?
Commissioner Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so there's a couple of parts to that. And one is, I think, this ability to allow LADCs to bill outside a treatment center. So the more that we can move towards really integrating our addiction services with our primary care, it serves not only to the benefit of the person receiving the services, but it also serves to help educate primary care about how to, you know, create these linkages between services. Nothing in this proposal, of course, speaks directly to the PMP data, but it does build on this fact that there are certainly people who are falling through the cracks and who aren't having their care coordinated. And it would be, you know, an expectation of this system as it continues to be built out that integrated approach to addiction as a disease would allow us to maybe even better use that data to help these individuals access those services.
Thank you.
All right. Representative Allen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So a lot of this was done to, well, regarding access, but also for reimbursement and to create funding for detox centers and then also as a treatment client-centered, moving, trying to streamline, trying to get people into, and then working. I would imagine there would be nonprofits that could hire people to provide reimbursable or medical-type reimbursement services. But if you have it, in 2015 you said that there was a definition of what is withdrawal management services. If you could provide me that information, just a site or something. And also, as part of this work, was there any sort of study or consideration of with heroin, opioid addiction, to go look at treatments where they're doing maintenance, so that, you know, somewhere in Kansas where they where you can, individuals that are long-term addicts that just not successful in getting clean, that they can maintain by going into a safe environment twice a day. So, and so that, is that permitted under this withdrawal management, would there have to be additional authorization for that type of, moving towards that type of
limited treatment.
Commissioner Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so we can certainly get you. During the 2015 session, the licensing standards for those two tiers of withdrawal management were passed, so we can certainly refer back to those. You know, in terms of the way that this interacts with medication-assisted treatment or different ways of, you know, approaching the opioid crisis, there's no direct linkages in this proposal. Though, you know, the use of peer recovery supports and care coordination will certainly interact closely with our strategies to addressing the opioid crisis, which is, you know, we are currently in the process of putting together an application for the state targeted response grants that were authorized through the CARES bill, and really looking at the ways that we can help build up our office-based opioid treatment programs and also act, you know, really thoughtfully work with our behavioral supports so that they can, you know, allow medication-assisted treatment to work as effectively as possible. And so all of this does work together to address that, to address the opioid crisis. As we look at our data, you know, we know that that continues to be an urgent concern. We're also seeing methamphetamines rising even above opioids in some areas for treatment. And then, you know, our number one admissions to treatment still remains alcohol.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Commissioner. Last question, Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Wilson, very quickly, I know that a lot of people with addiction issues sometimes also have mental health issues, and so why they're addicted because they're self-medicating. So how does this, what you're proposing, get at that part of the problem?
Commissioner Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative, so again, a few core pieces of this will allow some of those addiction treatments to interact with our mental health system. So, you know, aligning with the way that we do peer recovery supports, or actually even greater access to medically monitored withdrawal management will help people as they are, you know, accessing withdrawal management services to be able then to kind of figure out where they need to go next in terms of addiction treatment, treatment for their mental illness. It is going to continue to be the challenge of both these systems to assure that we're integrating treatment, because it is true that there's a high level of co-occurring. And I do think pieces of this, and also, again, that ability for clinicians to bill outside of Rule 31 facilities will allow them also to interact more closely with our community mental health centers or with our school-linked mental health providers. So there's certainly opportunities that this begins, you know, to address that concern. We have a long way to go. So speaking of, we'll just get right to right to strengthening the infrastructure for community based living. So as the commissioner mentioned yesterday, we are well aware of the burden on the counties as they are shouldering the cost of care for individuals who are in our higher intensity state operated services past the time when they require that level of care. So this proposal is reinvesting monies back to the counties to allow them to build mental health infrastructure. So this can include, you know, local discharge planning capacity, looking at building out intensive residential treatment services in their areas, developing supportive housing options. It will be an RFP process that, you know, the state will administer that will be open to counties, really with the intent that the community infrastructure will be strengthened in order to prevent more intensive placements and also to assure that the counties have at least more resources to address the mental health needs of the people in their regions. And that was pages 174 through 176. I apologize. And then the final proposal in the behavioral health package is the redesign of intensive mental health services for children. This is page 186 through 189. So the children's mental health system is facing the same pressure as the CD treatment system, which is that facilities are being designated as IMDs, and we have, you know, close to 700 beds at risk of losing federal financial participation. So this proposal invests in the state meeting that those lost funds, and that will sunset on July 1 of 2020. And during this period, no new treatment programs that would meet the characteristics of an IMD would be allowed to develop. Now, similar to the CD world as well, this proposes an analysis of the children's mental health system continuum of care, and really, are we providing and how can we better provide intensive services before children need treatment? And then are we developing the right models of care once they do need treatment? So this could look at intensive outpatient wraparound services. It will look at our psychiatric residential treatment facility model and see if there are ways to build that out, since that is a model where you can capture federal funding. But this really is an analysis that's necessary to look at our capacity and see how we can develop a mature system that can be sustained with the resources that we have and provide the best treatment to our youth. And that's the behavioral health proposals.
All right. Well, thank you for your presentation. And with that, our time has elapsed, and we are adjourned.